Welcome to the Biden Transition Podcast, the podcast that discusses how President Joe Biden and his new administration will tackle some of America's most pressing issues. For our third episode, we've invited Jessica Hoosman, editorial director for VoteBeat US, to talk about voting rights. How do modern-day voting laws disenfranchise voters? Has the changing demographics of the South motivated the passage of these laws? Will Trump's false claims of a stolen election prompt conservatives to push even more restrictive laws in the future? And what can Congress and the Biden administration do to shore up voting rights and help enfranchise voters? Jessica in Windy, Oklahoma answers these questions and much, much more coming up next. Welcome to the Biden Transition Podcast. I'm your host, Danielle McClain, with today's guest, Jessica Hoosman. Jessica is the new editorial director for the pop-up nonprofit news organization VoteBeat US. You may know her from her previous work as the lead reporter covering voting rights for ProPublica's award-winning Election Land project. Thank you so much for joining us, Jessica, and congrats on the amazing new job at VoteBeat.
Thank you. I am really excited about it, and I'm excited to be here.
Awesome. Thank you. So this is not a new issue. States have been passing laws intended to make it harder for people of color and other populations to vote in the U.S. since the beginning. From the start, only white landowning men were allowed to vote. Following Reconstruction, Southern states passed Jim Crow laws such as literacy tests or poll taxes intended to prevent Black people from voting. The Voting Rights Act of 1965 banned racial discrimination in voting, but things still quite aren't equal. What does voter suppression look like today?
You know, I think that while it is certainly true in the vast majority of the country that only white landowning men were allowed to vote, that actually took a few different forms across the country because the Constitution prior to the 14th and 15th Amendments was essentially silent on voting and the mechanisms for election and who was and was not allowed to vote. So each state legislature approached that very differently. In the Northeast and a couple of Northeastern states, Blacks were enfranchised in the 1840s prior to the passage of the 15th Amendment. And Rhode Island, for example, didn't initially ratify the 15th Amendment because they didn't want Irish people to vote or new immigrants to vote. But then in other territories, citizens were entirely enfranchised because they used that as a way to get people to move out to these brand new territories. So voting rights in the United States have actually ebbed and flowed as legislators have found it to be prudent for the entire time that this country has been a thing, right? We've given people their rights and taken them away again. We've given it back to them and taken it away again. And so I think that what we're seeing now is just a more refined version of that, right? The United States has enfranchised so many people over the last 200 years that when we roll back voting rights, it seems very foreign and it seems like we are really striking at the heart of American democracy. But I think that that has been happening since the dawn of the United States. And I think now it just seems more cynical and a little bit grosser because we are all so plugged into these issues now because the president has given so much platform for them.
So what are some of these laws that states are passing now that make it harder for people of color, young people, and others to vote? What kind of impact have they had?
So this year is such a weird year because we were dealing with a pandemic on top of all of the other bullshit that we're dealing with all the time. As you looked and you saw states try to help their elections offices transition to the pandemic environment, right? You saw states took very different approaches. Texas, for some reason, banned drop boxes. Even though in Texas you have to show your ID before you hand over your ballot, it's a very different situation. There were some states that mailed absentee ballots to every single registered voter. There were some states that made it very difficult to become an absentee voter, even as we're dealing with this pandemic. I think those are the most obvious things. But even if you take another year back, you can see that states are trying to implement ever more draconian voter ID laws. Redistricting has become a huge problem. Districts are just gerrymandered into these wild shapes so that legislators can achieve the outcomes that they want. And then, you know, they're also doing subtler things like making it more difficult to be a volunteer voter registrar or to do voter registration drives or to transport people to the polls or their ballots to counting boxes. So I think it's a bit of death by a thousand cuts. And whether or not any of them are actually that effective at disenfranchising a lot of people is perhaps not the point. I think the point is for a certain population to feel like their rights are being infringed upon and perhaps there's nothing they can do. And then for the other side to feel like they are the true protectors of democracy and the left just wants illegal immigrants to be able to vote by the busload. I mean, it's a very powerful political point of anger.
There are shades of Jim Crow still in effect as well. I know Florida, after the referendum to enfranchise people who were former felons, there was a pushback by the state government to implement what people are calling a poll tax. What happened there?
You know, in Florida, this was such an interesting situation. So the voters in Florida voted overwhelmingly to re-enfranchise felons. And then the Republican-dominated state legislature started to roll that back almost immediately. First, they said that they couldn't vote at all until their restitution was paid. And for some folks, that's thousands and thousands of dollars. For other folks, they don't even know how much restitution they owe because they've never been given a full accounting because our criminal justice system makes total sense. And that was upheld by a couple of different courts. And so the end result is that folks are having to track down their restitution and pay it, which often they can't. And so there's been this whole interesting effort by activist groups and well-funded philanthropists to either get counties to waive the debts and declare them debt-free, which a lot of counties have done en masse. And then there are other efforts for nonprofit groups to pay off the restitution of these folks so that they can be enfranchised. What you see happening, though, is that these solutions are very split on an urban-rural divide. So urban counties have taken haste to deal with this problem and to either reduce the amount of restitution or at least give them a final number or completely waive restitution fees in general are happening in large urban communities, whereas redder, more rural counties have done nothing to deal with this problem because they don't feel like it's a priority. And so while there are solutions, those solutions are being irregularly brought, and it's creating a really interesting dichotomy between, you know, urban ex-felons and rural ex-felons. And I'm interested to see how that plays out for the state's politics.
You know, you hear people like Stacey Abrams, who narrowly lost a race for governor in Georgia a couple years ago, talk about the changing demographics in the South. Abrams, of course, was one of the leaders in the push by Democrats and advocates to shift the reliably red Georgia blue during this November's presidential race and this month's Senate runoff election. What is happening to the demographics in the South? And are these voter suppression laws part of an effort by Republicans to hold on to power amid the shift?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question. The demographics in the South are not radically different than they were 4 years ago. I think that certainly the South is becoming more diverse. But a lot of what's happening is that for a really long time in the South, it was obvious that this demographic change was coming because while people who vote were not necessarily demographically diverse, the population was, either because there was a very large number of people of color under the age of 18 in these places that were not yet able to vote, or because there were people who were unable to vote for whatever reason, whether that's because they had a felony on their record or because they were not a citizen. Those people have come of age. Those people have been enfranchised because of felon laws that re-enfranchise them. These people have become U.S. citizens. And so this is just an inevitable conclusion of the way that the demographics in the South have looked for a really long time. And if you take a look at the way that the Republican Party has sort of facially attempted to accommodate these changes, you can see that there are factions in the Republican Party that have been telling people, you just have not adjusted to what voters want anymore. Like, you're stuck in the past. I mean, you hear Brad Raffensperger, the Georgia Republican Secretary of State, who's been hit so hard by his own party and by the president, saying, you know, Georgia's demographics have been changing for years and this party has not adjusted to them. And now that you have officially lost fairly for the first time because you've been ignoring all of these signs, you want to blame it on the system, but it's not the system, it's the voters. And so I think that there are pieces of the voter disenfranchisement laws that have passed in recent years, like the voter ID laws and the gerrymandering that's happened, certainly, and even laws that roll back vote by mail or absentee voting, that are clearly efforts to disenfranchise people who they don't want to vote for them while holding on to their base. And this is true for two reasons. The actual physical disenfranchisement, like making it impossible for these folks to vote, is certainly one of them. But in reality, if you're a historical voter and you've been voting for a while, it's kind of hard with these laws to disenfranchise you. I don't know that a voter ID law or certainly redistricting will, given what it can do, but like these little laws, like the voter ID law or the exact match law in Georgia to a certain extent, will disenfranchise people, absolutely. And that's sort of facially unacceptable. But I don't know that it will disenfranchise so many people that it justifies what people are claiming, which is that they're doing this to literally disenfranchise people. I think one of the other reasons they're doing it is because it is good politically for them, for their base to be very angry, right? And you saw the power of that for the last 4 years with the Trump administration. So even if your voter ID law meaningfully will not actually disenfranchise 2 million people, even if it will just give people the impression that you're trying to make it harder for them to vote, and so they sort of give up, what it will do is really invigorate your most strident, I'm definitely turning out base, right? Like if the Republican Party can make themselves, and they have endeavored to do so over the last 4 years, into the party that cares about free and fair elections, and they can make people believe that the Democratic Party wants dead people to vote, and they want illegal immigrants to vote, and they want people busing people across state lines to vote in New Hampshire's elections. If they can get their base to believe that that is true, that is incredibly politically powerful. And I think that the end result of trying to convince your base that that is true is the insurrection that we saw. I mean, like you can only push your base to believe that the system is completely rigged against you for so long before that becomes untenable.
Obviously, there is a real fear that voter fraud is a thing and that votes are being stolen. We saw that with the people storming the Capitol this month. Is voter fraud a real issue? And do these laws actually do anything to stop it?
You know, this is like the most common question that I'm asked. I think certainly voter fraud does happen, right? Like, anyone on the far left who says that there is never any voter fraud is really in over their skis. I mean, like, it certainly does happen. There are very rare instances of people selling their votes. It is especially bad in rural white Appalachian areas. It is not uncommon for people to, for example, sell their vote to a candidate for a painkiller. Like that, this is like publicly available information. That does happen. People do take it upon themselves to do pretty inappropriate and borderline illegal ballot harvesting initiatives. I mean, you saw that in North Carolina 9. There are people who will vote in place of their dead spouse or their dead sibling. Like these things do happen, but they are very rare. It is not impossible for that amount of fraud to flip a very, very small local election. It would be the stuff of science fiction novels for it to happen to even a countywide or a statewide or especially a federal election. I mean, it just doesn't happen at the rate that it would need to in order to have actual electoral impacts. But that's not really the point, right? Like we're living in a post-truth environment and we're so polarized that people are willing to believe that the other party is manipulating the vote count in such a way that even though it's functionally impossible to do, people still believe it. And I think that that's really the danger of all of this rhetoric that the Republican Party and to some extent the Democratic Party have been, you know, going on about for so many decades.
Clearly, Donald Trump's efforts to overturn the election is not going to work. And his claims of voter fraud is just pure science fiction. But what kind of fuel does his claims give to state lawmakers to pass even more restrictive laws and making it harder for people to vote?
Oh, this is what I'm actually really worried about. I mean, I think that this year we're going to see a lot of Republican lawmakers stand up and even perhaps eagerly and with a sense of good faith declare that so many people have such concerns about our election system that we need to pass election integrity laws, even if they won't have an impact on the actual integrity of the election, it will have an impact on people's confidence, right? We saw that with every voter ID bill that passed when they were taken to federal courts and the plaintiff said, hey, this law will have absolutely no impact on election integrity. The people who wanted those laws to pass would sort of agree to that point. Like, yeah, it probably won't do much of anything, but it will make people feel better. And judges have ruled that that is a valid reason to pass a law. And so I think that there is enough case law and there is enough historical precedent for that, that we're going to see a rash of these laws, right? Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley, for example, they know better than the fact that the election was actually stolen. But if you listen to what they were saying carefully, they were saying Americans are concerned and we have a duty to answer their concern. And so it wasn't about whether or not the election was actually stolen or whether the results should legitimately be called into question and we should vote against them to certify them. It was that people were concerned. It doesn't matter that Hawley and Cruz are the ones that made them concerned. It doesn't matter that these Republican lawmakers that are going to eventually pass these laws are the ones that caused the problem in the first place. That amount of logical reasoning is not going to happen. They are going to use the concern as a springboard to pass additional laws that are disenfranchising.
Any new laws that are being proposed that could be pushed in the coming years?
You know, I think one of the most common things we're going to see is states that have voter ID laws already will very likely find a way to require some identification for mail-in ballots. Because one thing that we know from studying years of voting rights history is that once you make voting easier, it's very difficult to roll that back. So we have given millions of Americans the new freedom to vote by mail, and people are not going to want to let that go. So that, like, that bell cannot be unrung. And so Republicans now are faced with a situation in which, in order to appease their voters, they have to continue letting them vote by mail. But one of the most common things that we heard as a complaint about vote by mail as it was ramping up for this election was that there were no ID laws in most states that required people to vote by mail. So, for example, in Texas, people over the age of 65 can vote by mail for any reason. Like, there's an age limitation. The same is true in Alaska, but they don't have to submit like a copy of their driver's license if they mail that ballot back in. If they drop it off at a polling location, they do have to show their ID, but if they put it in the mail, there is no ID requirement. And so I think that that's the first thing that we're going to see is a lot of states like Texas and Georgia and Indiana that saw a large increase in vote by mail this year will likely pass requirements that some method of identity verification, aside from signature matching, some photo identification requirement will be required, I think. And I wouldn't be surprised to see those bills introduced within the first couple of weeks of state legislatures convening this week.
So let's turn to what the Biden administration and the Democratic-controlled Congress can do. Congress last year passed the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. What is the John Lewis Voting Rights Act and what exactly would it do?
Yeah, so I mean, the House passed this. I don't know that the Senate has yet, but it's essentially a re-up of the Voting Rights Act. So all of the things that you've heard Democrats talk about in terms of their desires for things to be a little bit more fair would be involved in this. It's the Voting Rights Advancement Act. And so the idea is that it pulls from historical ideas about what should and should not happen with voting and puts them on the table. So for example, one of the first sections is on voting on Indian land. And so it would provide for additional protections for reservations to have a polling place physically on them and require equitable voting locations to be provided there. It would also set up a little bit more of an opportunity for citizens to have the ability to sue under this act when their rights have been compromised. And that was really rolled back with a couple of court decisions under the current Chief Justice. And it would also set up a little bit more preclearance, which was rolled back with the Shelby County Act of 2013. So I think its intention is to really establish a lot of the protections that the voting rights initially had that have been rolled back over the years. And I think that it would also solve a lot of problems that were kind of inherent within the Voting Rights Act. So while, you know, it's unfortunate that preclearance was rolled back at the Supreme Court level, the Supreme Court was not wrong that the formula that upheld preclearance was outdated and did not take into consideration newer instances of voter suppression that were happening in non-covered areas. I think there's this myth about Shelby County that the entire American South was set up for preclearance and no one in the North was, but that's really not how it was. You know, there were certain sections in the South that were not covered as you might expect them to be. There were whole swaths of Florida that were not covered by the Voting Rights Act, and New York City's five counties were covered under preclearance, right? So it was a little bit more scattershot than I think people believe it was. And so the formula did need to be updated. And so H.R. 1, the Voting Rights Advancement Act, would do some of that.
Would that solve all the issues? Is that like the silver bullet?
No, I mean, it would not. The primary reason that it wouldn't is because the federal government actually has not that much authority over voting. There is no mechanism in the Constitution or in established federal or case law that would allow the federal government to make sweeping changes to the way that states conduct their elections. The Constitution vests authority for managing elections and determining who is able to vote with the states, which is why, for example, there is a variety of different requirements for felons. Some states have never disenfranchised felons. Some states still do. And that's because states, under the literal text of the Constitution, have the power to make those choices. And so given how much the federal government's abilities to standardize elections, especially local elections, you know, given their limitations there, what they can really do is impact federal elections and set up standards for states whose laws will touch on federal election issues. The federal government just doesn't have enough authority to solve all of the problems that are going to happen, right? That a lot of this is going to have to happen at the state or even the county level.
Obviously, passing anything through the really closely divided Senate would be difficult. Is there anything that the Biden administration could do without having to go through Congress?
You know, I think probably not. I like one of the things that they could do is sort of refresh the federal, the light federal institutions for elections that already exist. So the Election Assistance Commission, for example, is an existing federal agency that has many of the same political structure problems as the Federal Elections Commission, right? It's got four commissioners, two Republicans, two Democrats. They deadlock on basically everything. They're supposed to be a clearinghouse for election administration best practices, and they also certify voting machines for states, which 49 states require that their machines be certified at least to the basic standards that the EAC sets out. And so if any federal organization has influence over elections, or at least can percolate good conversations as it relates to the elections, it's the Election Assistance Commission. But that commission has been basically hamstrung. The people who are the commissioners, especially the Republican commissioners, have no real interest in that organization. They don't do much of anything to advance its goals. It is filled with internal strife. Its budget is also a fourth of what it used to be. And they are certifying machines to a standard that was passed in 2005 before the advent of the first iPhone. So if the federal government wants to do something about elections, or to at least support election administration and best practices, then they could set a better budget goal for the EAC, which is entirely within the White House's purview. Whether or not Congress would allow them to, I don't know. But given now that Democrats control both houses, even if narrowly, I think that that's something that they could do. Like, they could make the EAC a functioning agency that is set up to give good advice and to certify machines to a standard that is acceptable in the year 2021.
Would it be fair to say that the most effective way to make voting more equitable would be for Democrats to win state elections?
I think that the answer to that depends. I think, one, it depends on the appetite of Democrats to do the work that they're going to need to do, because there are even conservative Democrats that believe a lot of incorrect things about voting. It's going to take a lot of voter education to make a lot of these laws work in the way that they need to work. But then I think part two of this is that Democrats also need to have a little bit of an awakening when it comes to the way that they talk about voting laws. And what I mean by that is I have seen a lot of Democrat activist groups go really hard on the idea that all voting changes that happen in any given jurisdiction are inherently suppressive or racist. And they make people believe that their vote truly does not matter because there is all of this system set up to work against them. And that can be powerful in making people feel like they need to turn out because people are trying to get them not to and invigorate them to go to the polls. But it also has a very clear effect of making people feel like the system is rigged against them. In the same way that it is only possible to tell Republicans for so long that their votes don't matter because they're being canceled out by fraudulent ones, it is also damaging to tell voters of color and progressive voters that their votes don't matter because Republicans are rigging the system against them. And sometimes they are, right? Like sometimes these laws are targeted in that way. Like I think we can make a pretty clear case for a lot of the voter ID laws that have passed, a lot of the redistricting that has gone on. But sometimes they are local decisions that are not suppressive in any way. So, for example, every time new numbers of polling locations come out and the polling locations have dropped in number, we see a gigantic flood of words in this space saying this is bad, this is disenfranchising, we're hurting voters. But that may not actually be the case. A lot of the reasons that polling locations have closed down in recent years is because people are much more likely to vote by mail now. A lot of places have turned to, instead of requiring you to go to a specific precinct, they have turned to a voting center model so that you can vote anywhere in the county. And then they remove the polling locations that people don't tend to go to, which may look like they serve, you know, Black and brown populations. But if those people aren't voting at those locations because they're voting closer to work or closer to their kids' schools, then why spend the money to have a polling location that five people are going to vote at open all day when there are 100 other options, right? Like, I think that you and I can both reasonably look at that and determine that that's simply an efficient use of resources and not inherent discrimination or disenfranchisement. But that's often what these activist groups call it. So I think that the entire space needs to have a little bit of a reawakening in terms of how we discuss these voting changes. And we all need to be realistic about the idea that elections are not well funded. They are not well resourced. It's not a professionalized group of people running these elections. And so given that we have professionalism constraints and given that we have funding constraints, we have to make the best choices for what's going to serve the most voters. And we should certainly pay attention to the voters that need the most help. And we should make those decisions based on that. But I do think that we're all going to have to grow up a little bit and discuss the reality of voting without making everything about fraud or suppression. Like, much of what actually suppresses people is just the void of resources and the void of education in this space. And so if we can collectively move towards better resourcing our elections and better educating our voters on how the system works, I think that's going to be a lot more effective than passing legislation.
How important would additional federal funding be in terms of giving election officials the resources they need to make sure that everybody gets a chance to vote?
It's critically important. Funding and the consistency and predictability of funding is honestly far more important than any structural legal changes we could make to the system. It is absolutely true that laws disenfranchise so many people, but what is more true is that poorly resourced elections officials simply do not have the tools that they need to educate voters and to train poll workers in a meaningful way and to buy the equipment that they need. And from my perspective, so many more people are disenfranchised because of bad voting equipment and poorly trained poll workers than they are bad voting policy. most people who are going to vote are going to show up to vote. And if they have the help of an effective poll worker, and if the machines are working well, and if there are an adequate number of precincts, then they will vote, and they will vote easily, and they will vote. Even if they have an issue, they may have to cast a provisional ballot. But if the poll workers know what they're doing, if you walk in the door to vote, the likelihood that you walk out of the door and you have not voted is really low. And so I think that not only do we need federal funding, but we need some sort of predictable structure for federal funding. So if you look at the way that elections have been funded in the last two decades, it's a bit scattershot, right? Like, we had a bunch of money released in 2002 because of the Help America Vote Act. There have been a couple of like random infusions of $400 million here or $400 million there. And that's great. But, you know, I think that there is a real misconception at the federal level for how fast money can be spent at the state level. I think people thought, okay, well, let's just give everyone $1 million in March and they'll have what they need before the November election. But that's not realistic in any way. A lot of the money that was spent because of the federal disbursements this year in preparation for the pandemic were spent on future elections and not the election of 2020, because government procurement takes a long time. Figuring out how to buy and train your employees on new tools takes a long time. We didn't have that time as we were moving towards the 2020 election. If federal funding, even if it came at a lower level, like even if it was $100 million, if that happened every year and state and local officials knew that they could count on it and knew that it would be coming and they didn't have to scramble around every 4 or 5 years to figure out how they were going to spend the money so they could qualify for the grants, then I think that we would see a gradually improving system. But right now, the system is so unpredictable. Like, I mean, I don't know how anyone would live their lives if they didn't know when their next paycheck was coming. And in 2 years, they got $1 million and they waited 5 years and they got $500,000. Like, how do you plan your life? How do you plan financial improvement? How do you plan when you're going to buy a house? Like, the same is true with election officials. If you don't give them a clear understanding of what their budget's going to be every year, then there's just no way for them to plan improvements. And so I think that even more important than the dollar amount of federal funding is the consistency and predictability of it.
Thank you so much for joining us, Jessica.
Yes, this was really fun. Thanks for having me.
And thanks so much to all of you for listening. I'm Danielle McLean. You can listen to the Biden Transition Podcast on BidenTransitionPodcast.com, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and more. Stay tuned for more episodes in the coming weeks for more expert insight into how Team Biden will tackle America's most pressing issues.